Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
All right, welcome to another edition of Mysterious Radio. I am your host, K-Town, and if this is your first time listening, I want to welcome you. And those returning, thank you for your continued loyalty to the show. And I apologize for my voice. Okay, I'm nasally, so I apologize. I'm very sorry. My special guest tonight is John Kachuba to discuss his book about the paranormal called Ghost Hunting Illinois, where he takes us on a guided tour of Illinois' most haunted locations. All right, so let's get to it. All right, I have joining me tonight special guest author John Kachuba to discuss his book, Ghost Hunting Illinois. John, I want to thank you very much for joining me tonight on Mysterious Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Before we get started, John, can you tell us more about yourself and what inspired you to write about the haunted side of Illinois?
Sure. Well, I can tell you what basically prompted me to write about the haunted side of any place. I grew up in New England, and, you know, growing up there, heard all the history stories as well as all the ghost stories from there. And I had the occasion, part of that time, to live in the same town as Ed and Lorraine Warren, and probably most of your audience would recognize them as sort of, I call them America's godmother and godfather of ghost hunting. I had a chance to meet them and show them some photos I had taken and everything else in Connecticut, and they kind of basically really spurred my interest into sort of looking into these things more intently, I guess. So I moved out to the Midwest several years ago and wrote two books about Ohio, Ghost Hunting Ohio and Ghost Hunting Ohio on the Road Again. And people kept telling me, you know, you ought to do Illinois. I didn't know why, but I had spoken to folks like Ursula Bielski in Chicago and Dale Kaczmarek and some other folks like that. Taylor, I forgot his first name, in India and Illinois as well. And they all told me this was a good place. And so I was intrigued by their stories and just went to Illinois. I spent probably maybe 6 or 7 months, I guess, off and on traveling through the state, collecting stories, you know, firsthand observations, as well as firsthand stories from people that have experienced things that, you know, I wasn't there to see. So it was an interesting trip, to say the least.
All right. Very good. Now, these places that are in your book, are they open to the public?
Yes. Every place that I write about is open to the public. I'd like my readers to actually go to these places and experience, you know, whatever they may experience. And I personally go to every one of these places myself. So I write these stories from a first person eyewitness account. Now, I'm not saying that every time I go to one of these places, something paranormal happens to me. That would be, you know, the jackpot. But I've gone to enough where things have happened. And as I say, I interview folks that are there all the time and get their stories as well. But yeah, they're open to the public. And in fact, in the back of each of these books, I have sort of a directory, if you will, that gives you the street address, the phone number, hours of operation, if it has hours, if it's got a website, the website's posted. So a lot of people have actually used these as sort of paranormal travel guides, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great that you you know, went the extra mile to include all of that. Now, are some of these locations private homes?
No, they're not. I've had people approach me and say, you know, I've got a great ghost story for you or whatever, but it's been in a private home or it's been on private property. It's been places where I know the public just can't go. So as happy as I am to hear the story, I really can't use it in my books because the whole idea, as I said, is to get people to actually go out and maybe experience some of these things themselves.
Now, you do give some guidelines about ghost hunting. I assume because you met Ed and Lorraine Warren, you were inspired to be a ghost hunter. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I met them many years ago, and I actually wrote about some of my experiences and interviews with them in another book I have called Ghost Hunters, which is a different type of book. Actually, it's my favorite ghost book that I wrote. But they certainly gave me some ideas about how to do it, but it wasn't too many years later that I started doing it. And primarily, I consider myself maybe a ghost journalist, if you want to call it that. And I think my writing shows that I'm interested in telling the story and what actually happens. And what I did for these locations is many times I was there on my own with very simple equipment, you know, a camera, maybe a recorder of some kind, an audio recorder, dowsing rods. I use dowsing rods. But I don't have a lot of the heavy electronic gear that you see on television programs, for instance. However, having said that, for a lot of locations, I would work with different ghost hunting groups who would invite me and say, hey, you know, we heard you're doing this and we're going to be doing an investigation at, you know, this location. Would you like to come along with us? And say, yeah. So I've been on those types of investigations, although, you know, the equipment wasn't mine and it was a ghost group. And I don't belong to any particular group. I'm an independent that works with a lot of different folks.
You do give some guidelines. So do you mind just telling us about some of those? Because they're great pointers, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first thing is whenever you're going out to do this, it's always to be safe, you know. So I recommend that even though I did it myself alone in some places, I don't recommend that even though I did it. I do recommend that you go to locations with people who know what they're doing. And by that, I mean, there are certainly people that like to go ghost hunting, if we'll use that term, as kind of just something you know, like fun to do, something crazy to do, but they're not necessarily serious investigators. And I think part of that is because of television programs making it so popular that everybody feels they can go out and look for ghosts. So I recommend, first of all, trying to find some group in your area or something, and that's easy enough to do. Just go online and do, you know, I'm in Cincinnati, do ghost groups in Cincinnati, and you'll get a whole bunch. And to maybe, you know, talk to those people and see if they're willing to have you come along with them. So I'd recommend doing that. I also say that you need to have respect for what you're doing, respect for the property that you may be investigating, but also respect for the fact that you are actually contacting or trying to contact the spirits of people who were like us. They were flesh and blood human beings. And, you know, they need to be treated with that same kind of respect. Just because they don't have a physical body anymore doesn't make them any less human in a sense. I mean, you need to treat it with respect. It's not a joke. It's not something to be treated lightly. I also say that you should make sure you have all the right equipment. You know, if you're running anything electronic, make sure you have the right number of batteries because batteries burn out, all that kind of thing. Make sure people know where you're going, who you're going with, you know, when you're expected to return. So a lot of those things. I actually write about that in the beginning of the books, sort of in a preface. I break out everything, you know, fairly detailed to give people an idea of how to go about an investigation. But I think it's really two words, I think, safety and respect, I think, you know, probably sum it up pretty well.
I totally agree with you. You're right. Some people don't do either, and that's unfortunate, you know?
That's right.
All right, so let's get into some of these places, if you don't mind. First,
sure.
Let's talk about Biograph Theater. Is it still being used, and what's the story behind that location?
Right. So the Biograph Theater is a theater that's been around for a long time, and it's in downtown Chicago. I think it's – I don't have the book right in front of me. I believe it's Lincoln Avenue. But in any case, it's a landmark. It's a historical landmark. And why it's historical is because I'm sure many people out there have heard the name John Dillinger, you know, public enemy number one for many years. The FBI was after him, you know, continually, always trying to get him. And they finally did get him in the Biograph Theater. They actually had a plant that went in and sort of tipped off the police to where he was and everything else in the theater. So when John Dillinger came out of the Biograph Theater, he was met by quite a few police officers, FBI and local police, quite a few. And basically, he tried to get away, and they just he was shot. He was shot and killed right on the sidewalk in front of the Biograph Theater. So just as that alone, it's become a famous location, and people go just for that history, you know, the sort of criminal history of the U.S. Because he was a big figure there. But what happens is people say that they can still see at times the image of Dillinger actually on the sidewalk, that, you know, at the right time, at the right moment. And I don't know exactly when that would be, but that you will see this sort of ghostly figure come out of the theater and literally stumble across the sidewalk and then and disappear as if he was, you know, shot. So that's it. The interesting thing is there really is doesn't seem to be any hauntings inside the theater. Part of that might be because the interior has been completely renovated, so it doesn't look anything like it did in Dillinger's day. But the exterior still looks like it was, you know, in Dillinger's day. It has a big marquee out over the sidewalk and everything. So that's the story with that, a historical gangster and, you know, apparently still at the site of where he was killed.
You did visit there as well, right?
I did, yes. And so, in fact, when I went inside, I was disappointed because it had been renovated, and the renovation occurred, you know, a long time ago, but it wasn't anything like a theater that you'd expect from the 1920s. It had, you know, fairly modern seats, and everything was changed. So you really couldn't get the sense of what Dillinger would have experienced while he was inside, you know, watching whatever he was watching.
Oh no, I hate that.
Yeah.
You want the full experience.
Right. Like I say, especially when you're outside on the sidewalk and you look up and go, wow, this is, you know, look at the exterior. This is an old theater. And you see the marquee, and you can imagine Dillinger getting out of a cab or something and standing on the sidewalk, you know, looking at that same marquee and walking into these same doors and everything. And the exterior is, you know, kind of fancy. But as soon as you're inside, it's like, no, well, everything's changed.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, that's a great story. And you also put in there that some people think that police may have killed the wrong person, though, right?
Well, that's been a persistent rumor that perhaps it wasn't Dillinger. But, you know, most of the information comes about that. Yeah, it was. I mean, they had a body that they were able to identify and everything. But, you know, some of these legends, these urban legends, somehow get legs and they just continue on, even though there's not much of a basis in fact for them, you know?
Yeah. All right. Now, the area between Clark and LaSalle Street bridges is supposedly very haunted due to tragic deaths of many hundreds of people back in 1915. Can you tell us what happened there?
Right. This was quite a tragedy. It's funny because when we think of you know, maritime disasters, and we think of ships sinking and people, you know, we think of the Titanic, maybe the Lusitania that was torpedoed in World War I, but we don't think that probably one of the most tragic maritime disasters in U.S. history actually happened on the Chicago River in downtown Chicago within, you know, 4 or 5 feet of sidewalks and in only 20 feet of water. And what happened in 1915 was there was a steamship called the Eastland, and it had been chartered by a company. I think it was a telecommunications company in those days. I forgot exactly what it was. But in any case, they were taking their employees on an outing to some island or some location. And so they're all going to get in this steamer in the Chicago River and take a cruise to this location. So everybody's all dressed up. Now, this is 1915. So, you know, people aren't wearing shorts and T-shirts. The women are still wearing very long, you know, long dresses and heavy shoes, and the men are all wearing suits and all this kind of stuff. As they're loading the ship, it starts to lean over. It starts to list to one side. So the crew gets a little concerned. Now, this is still right at the pier. You know, people are getting on board. And they shift ballast around a little bit to try to level it off. And they do level it off. But more people keep coming on, and the ship starts to list again. And all of a sudden, within a matter of seconds, it rolls over onto its side. Well, by the time it does that, you know, there were several hundred people on board. A lot of them were already below deck. A lot of them were on the decks. And the upshot was that 800, I don't remember the exact number, 800 plus people died in that. They drowned within just a matter of minutes, most of them trapped below decks. And like I said, this is right in the view of hundreds and hundreds of people in downtown Chicago. You had people, you know, jumping off the sidewalks trying to rescue people. The police were there trying to get into boats. Everybody's trying to get them. It was horrible because you can sit there and watch this roll over and see what happened. So 800 plus people, something like 21 or 22 entire families were wiped out. Mother, father, children. It was an unbelievable tragedy.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
So as they were recovering the bodies, and this was quite a process too, they had to cut through the hull and everything else to get people out. They didn't know what to do with them. There were so many people, they didn't know where to put them. So they started laying the bodies out in the National Guard armory. It was the only facility they can find large enough. Like I said, 800 people, you know. Well, that armory now, or at least part of it, became Oprah Winfrey's television studio. So what happens now, and supposedly there was a video caught, a security video at Oprah Winfrey's studio that depicted a woman in what I would call not Victorian era, but the 1920s, you know, a long, heavy kind of dress with a hat and high boot kind of shoes and gloves and all this kind of stuff, just sort of drifting down the hall. This was supposedly recorded on a video camera, which I've never seen the tape, but that was supposedly what happened. And of course, there wasn't anybody in the building at that time. It was a security camera overnight. But people that have worked there in the studio have said they've heard strange noises. They've heard what sounds like crying or like children, and all this when there isn't when there isn't a crowd of people there or anything else. And the part of the studio too that this occurs in is not a part where the public would be. So it's not like where the audience would be sitting to view one of her shows when she had a show and she was taping it there. This was more like sort of backstage areas and things like that, or office areas and stuff. And that's where they were seeing these things. So people think that it was there, that it happened. There's another nightclub in Chicago that was a couple blocks away, and it's believed that some of the bodies may have been laid out there. And that place, too, it was a natural history museum for a while. Then it became a nightclub called Excalibur. And people there were having the same reactions, where they were saying that they were seeing people that looked like they were from another era. They were hearing the sounds of children and things like that. So, yeah. And I tried contacting Oprah Winfrey and her company when I was writing this book. And I didn't get any response from them. And I was told by other people who have tried to interview them that they refuse to talk about it, you know, so.
What about outside the area, like on the sidewalk? I assume that sidewalk's still there, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I don't know for sure. There's certainly been, as I said, these incidents that people have determined from inside the building. I don't know if anybody has seen anybody like outside on the sidewalks or anything. And I don't know either, if it'd be an interesting question, whether anybody's ever spotted sort of on that bridge between those two streets, because, I mean, that's the site. That's where the ship rolled over. You know, so you would think that that would be a location for haunting. But I haven't heard anything coming from there. I've only heard it coming from the locations where the bodies were laid out.
If that area is haunted, you can definitely see why it would be. So
sure. Absolutely.
Hmm. All right. So now people love to hear about haunted cemeteries. And you do mention a couple in your book. And one of those is Graceland Cemetery. Why do you think those places are haunted when it's not really the original place where these deaths occurred?
You know, that's a question that I've asked myself, because it seems to me, from what we know about hauntings, that it seems more often than not, a spirit is haunting a location that they loved, a place that was familiar to them, a place that they knew, you know, their home or a child's home or a favorite spot where they used to, a favorite tavern, you know, or whatever it might be.
Right.
But a cemetery, I mean, who spends any time in a cemetery? You're dead when you get there, right?
Right.
So you really didn't spend any time there. And I'm not sure what that's about. I wonder if sometimes if there isn't maybe some way that a spirit might be more or less trapped there. And I don't know how to explain that, because I'm not even sure what that means. But certainly there are cemeteries that do seem to be, you know, to be haunted. Graceland is certainly one, and I've written about other ones like that too. So I don't really have a strong explanation for that, because most of the hauntings that I've heard and have done have not been in cemeteries.
Tell me about Graceland. What have people been experiencing there? And it looks like it's a beautifully kept place.
Oh, it is. Oh, it's definitely, it's gorgeous. There's been a couple sightings. One of the most famous ones is actually the cover of my book. Yeah, I know you can't show it here, but it has a statue of a girl. Maybe, I don't know, she looks like she might be, you know, 8 years old or something like that. And it's a beautiful sculpture. It's done in marble, and she's sitting in a chair. She has a hat, and she has like a little parasol. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't remember when I saw it, but I thought there was like maybe a puppy at her feet or something. And it's a very beautiful statue. The thing with this one is that the woman, the girl's name was Inez Clark. And she was actually 6 years old, I guess it was, in 1880, when she was struck by lightning and killed, which is, you know, a horrible thing to imagine. But she's in this, her statue is enclosed in a glass box. And people have said that they have seen a girl that matches the description of the statue. The statue was taken from life, from a photo, so it's representative of what she looked like. People had said they have seen a girl walking around the cemetery, especially toward dusk type, who looks like Inez, the same kind of, you know, same kind of old fashioned clothing. Remember, she died in 1880, and looking like her. They've also said some very strange things, which is that when there's been storms that have come through Graceland, that the case that the statue disappears.
Oh, which, wow.
yeah, right. Very, I mean, that's like, okay. But I can understand it. If Inez has any control over it, you know, she doesn't want to get struck by lightning again. So I guess I don't understand that. But that's the story, is that the statue would disappear. And then after the storm, it's there. So, I don't have to make of that. But I certainly would take more stock in the idea of actually seeing her, because that is a more traditional haunting, a more traditional kind of ghost sighting, is, you know, to actually see the person like that. So so that's one. There's a statue there too called Eternal Silence, which there's not really a ghost story attached to it so much, but it is a very eerie statue. It's larger than life. It's probably, you know, it might be like 7 or 8 feet tall, and it's a figure that's completely shrouded in this hood, a big long shroud. All you see are the eyes and just like the nose, and the shroud even covers over the mouth, but the nose is shiny, because when people come to the cemetery, they rub the nose to keep spirits off and they get good luck. So they've kept it shiny all these years, you know.
Okay. But,
Yeah. But Gracie, Inez Clark is probably the most well-known ghost there. And there's probably others, I'm sure, but is that I didn't spend a lot of time at Graceland. But it is a beautiful, beautiful cemetery. It's like a park.
I want to know if they have some type of, let me just ask you about the ghost hunting culture in Chicago. I don't know if you explored that part of it while you were there, but.
Oh, yeah, it's very much alive and well. You know, and this, and I'll tell you, okay, this is something that I've found amazing, is that probably in the last, let's say the last decade, it seems like every town in the United States has developed a ghost tour. You know, maybe it's a walking tour, or maybe it's a tour of just a couple of buildings, but it seems like everybody has one. Well, Chicago is very, very much a ghost hunter's kind of paradise. And there's a couple of people I mentioned a little bit earlier, but like Ursula Bielski, for instance, has been a major ghost hunter there along with Dale Kaczmarek, the two of them. They've done a lot of work there, and they've been doing it for years. Ursula does run a ghost tour of Chicago. There's been a Chicago ghost conference. I spoke at that one maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and that's still going. So people come to a haunted hotel in Chicago and stay there for the Chicago Ghost Conference. So yeah, it's a very strong community there.
All right, I'm talking to John Kachuba about ghost hunting Illinois, and I have more for you when we return right after this. And now, John, have you experienced anything strange or unusual during your research on these haunted locations?
Yeah, I have. One place that happened that I thought was very interesting was a place called Widow McCleary's Pub. And that's in Thornton, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And the short story there is that in the days of Al Capone, he was looking, we're talking about gangsters again, isn't that amazing? It's Chicago, right? Dillinger and Capone. Al Capone was looking for a place to run some of his bootlegging operations. And he approached a guy named McCleary, who had basically a brewery. And he tried to entice McCleary into going into business with him and allowing him to, start his bootleg stuff there and all that. And the brewery was closed because of Prohibition. Anyway, McCleary turned him down, and shortly thereafter, there was a fire, and oddly enough, McCleary died. So Al Capone then approached the widow and basically more or less threatened her into a deal where he got the property. So that became a place where he was doing some bootlegging operations. The ghost there supposedly might be either McCleary, who was killed, but there's also a ghost of a little girl there. And they're not sure who that is. They think it may have been the McCleary's daughter who was living there at the time. So I went to visit this place, and I was talking with the owners and everything else, and I was asking them some of the things that they experienced. And they said, well, the little girl, and I don't know what name they were giving her, but they had a name for her. Whether it was her real name or not, I have no idea. But they said, well, she's still here. And, if she... we can sometimes and call her up and entice her, and she'll come play with us. And I said, play with you? What do you mean? He said, come on, I'll show you. So we went upstairs, and the second floor was a pool table. And so they took the billiard ball off the table, and they said, now watch this. And they put it on the floor, and they pushed it and gave it a little roll, and it rolled like maybe 4 or 5 feet and stopped. Then they said something like, you know, are you here? You know, do you want to play? And meanwhile, the billiard ball is just sitting there. And I'm looking at it. I'm about 5 or 6 feet away from it. And so they kept saying that. And then before you know it, the billiard ball starts to move, right? And it starts rolling back to me. And it starts coming down, and it rolls maybe 4 or 5 feet. And then it stops, like like a foot in front of me, as if like, okay, hey, pick me up, or, you know, push me back, right? So it stops. And then it stops for a couple of seconds, and then it backs up. And it backs up like a foot or so. And then it stops again. And then it does like a circle, and then it stops. And I was just, I mean, I was amazed. I'm watching this billiard ball do this kind of stuff. It got to the point, then it stopped and it didn't move anymore. And so he said, Are you still here? And nothing happened. You know, so he picked up the billiard ball and took a look at it. And I said, let me see that billiard ball.
Yeah, you wanted to see if something was making it do.
Exactly. I'm thinking, has this got a weight on one side or something? But no, it was a solid billiard ball with nothing, you know, no, it wasn't manipulated in any way, and there wasn't any wires or anything. But what was amazing, I thought, was, okay, it was an old building. Now, I live in a house that's almost 100 years old, and we have wood floors, and not one room is level. You know, one goes one way, another one goes another way. You drop a marble on my floor in my house, and it's going to go all over the place. But this was unusual because the motion that it made, it was directional. You know, first they pushed it away, but then it was directional back to me, and it would stop and then start up again and stop. Now, no marble does that on my floor. It'll roll, but it'll roll to the lowest point, and that's it. It doesn't stop and back up on itself and go a different direction. So I was pretty amazed watching that. And they were kind of, they're pretty nonchalant about that. They said, "Oh yeah, this is her. You know, we play with her like this all the time." I said, "Really, all the time? Yeah,
yeah, like that's normal."
Yes, yeah, right, exactly. Like that's normal. Well, for some of the people that I've interviewed, that is normal, I guess.
So
there was another place. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead, John. Go ahead. Tell your other story.
Place, okay, there was another place in Springfield, Illinois, and it was.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
It's called the Inn at 835, and it's on 835. I don't know what the street address is, but it's in my book. But it's a bed and breakfast, and it originally started off as a small apartment building. And what was interesting about that was it was the first apartment building ever built and owned by a woman. And that was back like in the 1920s or something. But now it's a bed and breakfast. And what's happened there, they've had a few things. There was a bridal party that was using it, and in one of the rooms, I guess the women came up to dress or whatever, and they just felt really, really uncomfortable in that room, to the point where the bride actually said, "We're not staying here." Right now, I asked the owner, I said, "Well, what happened?" They said, "Well, there wasn't anything that they could pinpoint specifically, but when the women got there, they all just felt." Like this sense of depression, sadness, you know, just heavy, heavy atmosphere in a way. And, you know, the bride said, I can't deal with this. I can't take this. And they left. They didn't come back. There was another couple that was celebrating their first year anniversary. And they were upstairs. And they were, in sort of the bedroom area or whatever. But all of a sudden, all the faucets in the bathroom, including the bathtub and the sink, all turned on. And, you know, so water came gushing out and everything else. And then the man got, you know, upset. He ran in there and he turned it all off and everything. And he was kind of spooked by it. And after he turned it off, a couple minutes later, he went back to the room and they came on back on again. So he, too, said, you know, "We're packing up. We're getting out of here." You know, so my wife and I stayed there. I try to do that. If it's a hotel or something like that where I can spend the night or something, I always say, "Well, what's the haunted room? You know, give me the haunted room. I want to stay there." So we stay there. And one thing that they had said besides these incidents was that people, like especially the woman who was the night, like I'll call her the night clerk, the one who would be there overnight. She would talk about sitting at her desk, and her desk was a little desk sort of in the foyer of the building. And it was, you know, pretty dark, not a lot of light. She'd have a light on over her desk and the rest would be dark. But she would talk about frequently sitting there and suddenly looking up because she would see like some figure like go by, like a just like a shadow or something quickly go by. And she'd get up and she'd look, and there wasn't anybody there, you know, but she'd see these shadows. So my wife and I were spending the night there, and my wife was taking a bath, and I was on the bed and I'm reading, right? And I'm looking and reading the book, and all of a sudden I see like a shadow out of the corner of my eye. And I look to my right, you know, and there wasn't anything there. So I go back to reading. And as I'm reading, all of a sudden I see a shadow appear just like sort of on the right, but like higher, like a little bit above me. So I drop the book and look up there, and there's nothing there again, you know. And then the same thing happened on the left-hand side. And then finally I said, okay, I put the book down, and that was it. There was no more shadows. So I don't know what I was seeing, but, you know, they talk about sort of these shadowy kind of figures. And I was experiencing there in that room. And apparently they did not want me to read anymore, I guess. I don't know.
You know what? Bed and breakfast, sometimes, I don't know, just the thought of those scare me. Because I always think in the back of my mind, they're all haunted. They're all haunted, but... Well. You know, your story is, I think it's very common. And many times when I've did interviews with people, they talk about haunted bed and breakfast locations.
Yeah, I've got a few others. I mean, we're not talking about Ohio, but we definitely have other bed and breakfasts that that I've seen that happen. And, you know, it's not surprising because so many of those are old historic buildings. They've seen a lot of history. You know, there's been a lot that's gone on in those four walls. So it's not a surprise that there might be something still there.
Anybody die at the location?
Not that they knew of. I asked the owner that, and he said he wasn't aware of that happening. But, you know, who knows?
All right, let's talk about the Glessner House. That one caught my eye because the gentleman did not want his real name used in the story. Now, is that location haunted or no?
Well, I'll tell you, I think I'm probably the only person that has written about it. So I haven't seen anything else in print. And that's not unusual because a lot of times I find places that other people, you know, haven't found. But you're right. The person that I spoke to, you know, was an employee, and he didn't really want to talk about anything that was going on there, you know. So it's hard to say exactly what was going on. But the Glessners were a very, very rich family, and they lived in an area of Chicago. I think they call it the Prairie District. I think that's what it's called. And these were homes that were built by all these, rich industrialist magnates, you know, of the time. Like the guy from Otis Elevator, I think, had a place there. Pullman, the Pullman rail cars. I think his name was John Pullman. He had a house there. So these are all mansions, and they're very, you know, they're very rich, very posh. And you can take a tour of the Glessner House, but no one is going to talk to you about, you know, about ghosts there. So it's hard to say really, whether it's haunted or not. But this one person thought it was anyway, you know.
What did he say that occurred there?
The haunting was basically kind of an olfactory haunting where, you know, we get smells. And that's pretty common, too. You know, somebody will say, well, you know, I know it was grandma because I smelled her lilac perfume when I walked in the house, and that was her favorite perfume. Well, this was the same situation there. This person who was a volunteer at the house talked about Mr. Glessner having a particular bar of soap that he used to use, also a particular shaving cream or shaving soap that he used, and they had the same smell. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was lavender or whatever, but they had the same smell. And so when you go into the house today, some of his toiletries are still like on display in there. But I didn't smell anything. You don't smell anything. And he said, this gentleman at the house said that he had smelt it not just in that bathroom where you might expect to smell it because there might be a sample of it there, but he would smell it like in the kitchen, in the living room, almost going around the house, almost as if, you know, Mr. Glessner, who may have been wearing, you know, this particular fragrance or whatever it was, from soap or shit or shaving, was actually like sort of moving through the house. He could almost detect it that way. So that's not a lot of evidence. There wasn't anything visual, but you know, here's a person who has worked here many years and knew what was going on there and was talking about an olfactory type of haunting, which, you know, like I said, that happens.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Now, tell us about, there's this place that you have in your book that's really, when I first saw it, it's really not a place where people would generally think of as a haunted location, but you have the Museum of Science and History.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, tell us what's going on. What's going
right.
on there?
Well, that is strange. That was my reaction, too. There are two exhibits there that are supposed to be haunted. Now, I had mentioned the Pullman cars. Well, what they have there, they have a railroad car that was one of the old, what they called streamliners. And these are like from the 1930s. And they were, most of them were like these big silver, sleek kind of locomotives and passenger cars. They almost looked very futuristic, which was kind of the style, sort of the design style of the 30s was to look kind of, you know, futuristic. And so they have a car on display there. And you can walk through it. There's a couple of cars. And in the back, the last car, there's a family, and I'll put that in quotes, of animatronic figures, you know, like at Disney. You know? But they're creepy because, of course, they'll look at you and they'll talk and they'll move their hands and turn their heads. And they're talking about the train ride and what a great train ride it is. Well, so we know that that's animatronic, hard word to say, and that they are mechanical and that they're not real. So there's no reason in the world why they should still be moving when everything is turned off and there's no electric or anything else operating them, right? That would be what you would expect. And yet people like security guards and stuff have said that they've come through there and that they swear they've seen these figures move, you know, and that they've heard them. Well, okay. So they're thinking that something is haunting now those figures or in a way almost possessing those figures. So that's one thing. The other thing is they have a submarine in there. This is a great museum, by the way. I mean, even if you don't have any ghosts, it's just a great museum. But they have a submarine. It was a German submarine that was – the story behind it is that it came under attack by a British warship in World War II. And the British warship was dropping depth charges on the sub. These were explosives that would go off underwater. And try to knock out the sub. Well, the commander of the sub, the German commander, under this intense barrage from the British warships up top, basically lost control. He just kind of lost it completely and pulled out his service revolver and shot himself in the sub, killed himself. So the second in command took over and actually escaped. He actually got the sub out of that danger position and back to their port in France, which, you know, the Germans were already occupying France at that point. So he actually survived, and actually the captain would have survived too had he kept his cool. But in any case, he didn't, committed suicide. So people believe that his spirit is still haunting this sub. And the docents will talk about when you go into this exhibit, you would actually go into the sub. Now, it would be dark originally, and the docent that would open up in the day would have to go through it and turn all the lights on, and you'd have to actually walk through the sub to turn on these lights. And a lot of them have talked about, as they walked through, hearing footsteps that weren't their own, and several of them have talked about being touched, you know, like somebody touching them in the arm or the back or the shoulders or whatever as they're walking through. And obviously there's nobody in there. So they believe that the captain of that sub that committed suicide, that he's still there. Now, since I've written that book, the museum, they still have the sub, but they have redesigned the exhibit now. So I'm not sure exactly if you can still walk through in total like you used to be able to or if that's changed or not. But it'd be interesting to talk to somebody now. I certainly haven't followed up to see if they've had any more experiences too with the captain, as they call him. But yeah, very unusual place. One of the last places you would expect, you know, to find ghosts.
You're exactly right. And then there's another place here that hopefully I'm going to go visit pretty soon is the new aquarium that they built in Atlanta. I have read online that people have been experiencing things. And that really? Place is fairly new. Yes. I don't know if it's the location. I haven't actually dug into it, but I plan to go there. And I found that very interesting, just like the Museum of Science. I mean, it's not a place that you would normally think of as being haunted.
Right. Now, in the museum's case, you know, it's the objects within that museum. So, I mean, if that sub was on display, you know, at a shipyard or something else, it would probably still have the same thing going on. But, you know, in the case of the aquarium, unless we're talking about ghost fish, and I don't think we are, you know, then it could be the location, the area itself, the place where the aquarium is located. Maybe there was something there previously on that site, you know, that has something going on. Be interesting to know what you find out.
Yeah. And I love aquariums, and I just found that very unusual. So thank you for telling us about that one. Now, did the history of any of these places shock you? I mean, when you started digging into why it's haunted, did any of them really shock you?
I guess shocking, I'm not sure. There's a place in, I think it's Carlinville, it's called. It's the Loomis Hotel. And what I found interesting about that place, and I guess shocking, although maybe not to be surprised, it was a four-story hotel. And right now, the ground floor is, there's a couple of small little shops in it. It's not a hotel anymore. The second floor has a couple of offices. And the third and fourth floor are completely abandoned and in really bad shape. And so as I was exploring those, I talked about safety before. Well, I don't mean safety from other people, yes, but also safety from the environment itself. This was a very dangerous place, you know, stairs that would give away and all that kind of stuff. But on the fourth floor had been a brothel, you know, back in maybe the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s. And I found that not shocking that there was a brothel. I mean, I'm not that naive. I know there is such a thing as prostitution, and I know it's a, you know, a business in some places. But what I found shocking was the stories that they were talking about, some of the women that were there, and how sort of tragic it was that they had to turn to that kind of life, and also how dangerous it was for them, because at least one, if not, well, I think two maybe, women there were apparently murdered by, you know, by their clients, their customers, whatever you want to call them. And they believe that that's part of what the haunting is there. They've seen figures of women. They've seen figures of women crying in some of these rooms and everything, you know. So that was shocking in a different way. It was shocking more in the sense that it really made me just feel for those people, you know, like it's a terrible way to live your life, you know.
I agree. The Old Slave House.
I was just going to mention that in Equality, Illinois. And that was the other place I was going to say, now that's tragic. You know, slavery, of course, was tragic all around, any way you look at it. But the slave house, the old slave house, was particularly, particularly horrendous, I guess, because it wasn't just a slave owner that had slaves, but the person that owned that place was actually breeding slaves. And so he had a male slave that, this is crude, but I mean, you would have to call him a stud, that's what he was, just like an animal, like he used him to stud. And other female slaves, you know, he was required to, you know, create children with them. And he did, and they were slave children. So this person who was running this place was actually making quite a business. He was actually raising slaves and just selling them, you know. But the conditions of this place was horrible. They were kept, you know, chained to floors, chained to posts in there. There apparently was a lot of beatings and everything. It was miserable. It was slavery in its worst possible form. Now, unfortunately, when I tried to get into the old slave house in Equality, it was locked up, and it was owned at that point by the state of Illinois. And at that point, Illinois was having some financial problems, and so a lot of historic sites were closed, including that one. So there was no access. I couldn't get into it. I mean, all I got were stories that I heard from other people and that, you know, that were already recorded. But I could not get into it. And I went back a while later too, and it was still closed. So I don't even know today as we speak whether it's open again or if it's still closed or whatever. But there are supposed to be hauntings in that place as a result of the miserable lives that some of these slaves lived, certainly many of whom would have died there because of the conditions that they were kept in, you know, and the brutal conditions. So that's a place that I would say is shocking, you know, also realizing that slavery itself was shocking. But
I know you said it was, you don't know if people are able to get in that place, but yeah. Do you know of any past investigations or paranormal investigations that have been conducted there?
I'm not aware of any because it's been closed for quite some time. And like I said, I really, it'd be interesting. I should go up and check and see if it's open again, if anybody has done anything recently. I haven't gone back to check that.
Okay, John, this has been a great conversation. Now I want to give you an opportunity to tell my listeners where they can find more information about you and your books.
Sure. Well, they might be able to still find the books in bookstores. Some of them are pretty old, but if you can't find them, your bookseller could certainly order them for you, or you can get them on Amazon. All my books are on Amazon. If they want to just find out a little bit more about my books or read my blog, which is called The Metaphysical Traveler, all that, or my schedule of appearances, because like this show, I'm frequently on radio and podcasts, and I frequently do public appearances at libraries and universities and whatever. Best way to do that is just to go to johnkachuba.com, JohnKachuba, johnkachuba.com. And everything is there. You know, my books, you can get direct link to Amazon from there. You can see where I'm going to be. And actually, October coming up right now, this is a very busy time of year for me, as you can imagine, with Halloween. So I'll be very busy in the next month and a half or so. But yeah, everything's there, and people can contact me as well there if they'd like to, if they can make comments on my blog if they like, and, you know, comment to there too.
All right. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate your time and coming on Mysterious Radio.
Thank you very much, Kay. I appreciate your having me on.
All right. That's going to do it for tonight's edition. I want to thank John Kachuba once again for joining me tonight. I want to thank my producer tonight, Kim, and the Mysterious Radio team. I am your host, K-Town, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.